Free Thinker. This week, Cosmic Rebirth, North Mythology fact-checking, Who Murdered Mars, and the UK's planning to ban porn. Right. Let's begin episode 220.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. Ethan, thank you very much for showing up to my lecture.
Well, okay, so I got to set the record straight here. The past couple days, I have had the worst flu ever. This flu was more fluish than the bubonic plague and every other bad thing that has ever happened. And it all happened to me over the course of the past couple days. So unfortunately, I missed Don's fantastic presentation at Cafe Inquiry. Terribly sorry, Don, but yes. My health just demanded me to stay home and almost die.
Well, obviously, your priorities are really screwed up, but I'll forgive you this time, Ethan.
Well, thank you.
But for those of you who showed up, thank you very much. It was a very interesting and exciting event. There is a recording of the event that I hope to have up online sooner than later. Speaking of having things up and online, we need to have an apology to our podcast listeners who somehow missed about 20 minutes of the show where inexplicably the gremlins of the media just cut out our show. And we have no idea how or why it happened, but we're hoping to sort of redo the show in such a way as to make you all feel the joyous comfort of listening to a complete episode of Radio Free Thinker without any icky silent bits in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll reconfigure that past content, and we'll dive into some things like anti-vax, which is sort of where we, I guess, zoned out. But we'll get back to it in due time, so rest assured, listeners.
I suspect a conspiracy, but you never know. But speaking of recasting, redoing, rebirthing, there's a new old show on?
Yeah, that's right, Don. At Comic-Con this past weekend, the annual Nerdfest, they unveiled the new trailer for Cosmos, the TV series. And no, they're not re-releasing Carl Sagan's magnum opus. They're actually, well, I guess reinventing, making a sequel. Not quite sure exactly how they're classifying it, but it stars Neil deGrasse Tyson, and it is Cosmos. And it's really interesting. I mean, we play it for you. There's no, talking to go with it. It's just clips of Neil deGrasse Tyson looking at vistas of space.
And better CGI than Carl Sagan got to use for the spaceship that he flies around.
The Spaceship of the Imagination, I believe it's called.
Yes, exactly. But actually, I think it's a really good thing above and beyond, it's a good way to promote science and all that. But Cosmos, as great of a landmark as a show and book that it was, it's frankly dated. I mean, one of the downsides to having any kind of sort of a science show or book is the science keeps moving on. It's not dogmatic like some things like religion and that are out there. So there were a number of points or speculations that Carl Sagan had made in the original that we now actually have answers for. And there are a whole bunch of new questions that he didn't know that those were even questions when they redid the show. And I'm quite sure, and I mean, no one's seen the show yet, but I'm quite sure when Neil deGrasse Tyson does the Cosmos take two, that they will cover these issues. And you're right, it's not really a sequel or a prequel or a it's sort of the evolution of the show.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because when you look at what they've been saying about the new show, they want it to appeal to a broad audience, which is a double-edged sword because on the one hand, yeah, it's great to get science out there, but when you sort of generalize it to a certain point, you lose some of the detail and some of the finer points. And the other thing that was with Cosmos was that it wasn't so much about science as it was, I mean, there were large portions of it of just Carl Sagan talking philosophy. And I wonder if that would ever go over with today's audience. I mean, I don't know about you, Don. I've actually tried to show Cosmos to some friends of mine. And, you know, in some cases, I've had them fall asleep on me because it's... It is a slow-moving series, and there is lots of periods of Carl Sagan talking very philosophical and, you know, 1970s, 80s special effects of stars whizzing by, and that's not for everybody.
Well, and I wouldn't say it's slow. I think it's thoughtful. I think that's the word. And I think a lot of that has been lost in well, media in general, but scientific media. There are two really big pet peeves I have in modern documentaries that I see all the time, and it just annoys me. Is like you'll have a show about astronomy, and they're, you know, they're at the telescope and they're trying to see, well, and they go into, well, you know, today we had bacon and eggs for breakfast, and it's going to be a long, hard march up the mountain in order to get to the. I don't give a fart about that. It's an astronomy show. I don't care if you had to sacrifice your lung to get up there. Just tell me about the black hole or whatever it is the documentary is about. And the other thing is, and this isn't so much about, like, there are good science shows and bad science shows for this, but they spend about half the time repeating what they've already said because they go for a break. And they know that people's attention spans and memories seem to be so loose that when they come back, they spend like 3 or 5 minutes recapping what the previous 15 minutes had done. And that just, it drives me absolutely bonkers.
It is pretty annoying. And one of the other aspects that has become really commonplace is the visuals that go along with it. To a certain extent, it's almost become more about look what the latest CGI can do. And you watch some of these specials and you'll have some narrator, Neil deGrasse Tyson or Brian Greene or Stephen Hawking, speak over these amazing black holes created by computers. And on the one hand, yeah, that's great and interesting, but it's more about eye candy than it really is about the science.
FX porn.
Yeah. Which is, I guess, kind of relevant for today's topic.
Yeah. But what's not completely relevant for this topic is everything you know might be wrong. The Viking deception. We all know about the Vikings and their, you know, legacy sort of as the pirates of Christianity. And in that, I mean, you know, they're best known for terrorizing churches and the people of Britain around the 8th century. We all know they have the big pointy hats, which I guess actually they didn't. Most of us have probably watched the Avengers movies, you know, Thor, Loki. Most people should be familiar with, you know, Odin, King of the Vikings, and maybe you've heard about a thing called Valhalla and the Valkyrie. So, Ethan, what do you know about Viking religion?
Well, sort of what you just said. I've heard of, you know, the Freya and Thor and Loki and Odin and Thor's hammer and he made thunder and
stuff
happened.
Okay. Well, that's not for a historian. I love the depth and insight you have given to the subject.
Thank you.
It may surprise you to know that almost everything we know about Viking mythology comes from one author, a Christian. And it's in a set of literary manuals that were written about 300 years after the Vikings had converted to Christianity. The foundations of what we know about the religion of the Norse comes from this single author called Snorri Sturluson. Good name there. Yeah. Who wrote two salient texts around 1230 BCE. These are the Younger and the Elder Edda that are responsible for the way we see the Norse gods today. The Younger Edda is known as the Prose Edda, and the Elder one is known as the Poetic Edda. Scholars now believe, and this is a controversial topic, that these were actually manuals or teaching aids on how to do good poetry and good prose. Snorri was actually quite a famous poet in his day, and it's sort of, you know, in the tradition that we now have, like a Robert Downey Jr. doing, you know, how to be a great actor. So let's put this into context. The person writing about the belief system and religion of a people is the same person who would have seen themselves as the victim of these very same people. So there's very little for us to do as far as fact-checking. There are some references by people who used to trade with the Vikings, but their comments are kind of vague and ambiguous, and we'll get back to them a little later. Now, some would argue that, you know, there could have been pagans intermixed with the Christian population of 13th century BC. I mean, religions don't necessarily just die out in a blank slate. But it seems very, very unlikely. One of the ways that we can test this is that the burial traditions of pagan Vikings is to bury your worldly goods with the dead. So, you know, you have the ship with his gold and a horse and maybe his wife and all buried together. Not so for Christian Vikings. So thanks to archaeologists, we can see that they pretty much all converted at once and pretty much conveniently, completely. which again leads you to wonder how deep any sort of religious belief they might have had prior to this, as opposed to something brand new like a fad sweeping a nation.
Mm-hmm.
The impression Snorri attempts to put across is that the Norse gods are not actually gods, but heroes, like real people from history, who are sort of worshipped as gods. Well, this may be true or not. It may have been just a convenient way to sort of explain away a pagan past that might be a little uncomfortable for a Christian. And yes, I did kind of make a bit of a contradiction there, sort of saying in the first part, you know, he's writing about people who he hates, and now he's writing about people who he thinks he's one of. The author is full of, you know, competing biases, and that's kind of the whole point of the thing, right? Is that, you know, not to mention the fact that, you know, he has these pagan religious intermixings. He also played an important part at the time of a civil war that was going on in Iceland, which is where he wrote this stuff, which was trying to defend off conquest from either Denmark or Norway. I forget now off the top of my head. One example of where Snorri may have actually churched up the Norse gods is when he writes about the chief god Odin, who apparently sacrificed himself by being hanged on a tree and pierced in the side with a spear, and is followed by a sort of resurrection a few days later. Again, sounds pretty like a story we would have heard before. Now, someone will do research and find out there are lots of people writing Viking sagas. Yes and no. There are a few, although most of them were contemporaries with Snorri. So again, it was like they all were started writing about this stuff at the same time. For example, in Denmark, you had Saxo Grammaticus, who wrote a tome of his own. Snorri's work is pretty much uniquely the only one about the gods and the myths of the Viking. The rest are more like family history, retelling battles, and a large number of them are about saints and monks and their deeds. Okay, so what about the archaeology then? You know, are there any temples to Thor? No. It seems that if there were, they would have been made of wood. Scandinavia is not really blessed with things like sandstone or marble that you would have got in the Greeks and those sort of areas. So most of the things that they would have made would have just evolved, just dissolved away. Nor does there seem to have ever been a professional priest class. You might have a witch or a shaman type character, but not like a priest of Odin or that sort of thing. There are a number of artifacts with runic inscriptions, but they're kind of not very much help. Most are simply stating who owned this grave or this object or that sort of thing. A large number of them seem to be actually giving names to the items themselves, like your sword, which you might say, you know, this is Blade Stinger, Mighty Wielder of Death, those sort of things. I should take a moment actually to talk about the language. Snorri's book is written in Old Icelandic, and well, in my research, it seems that the end of the 13th, beginning of the 14th century, when this was written, is actually the time when the old becomes the Middle Icelandic period. But the point is, though, is it's the script. The alphabet used by Snorri was Roman or Latin characters. It seems that runes, which is an entirely different set of characters, the alphabet used by the Viking and the Norse from about 200 BCE, it's not really suited for long literary works. It was not until the adoption of the Roman alphabet, and I'm sure there were probably a few other technological advances that were brought up from the south that helped, that even made writing down these sagas and histories or religious texts of the Vikings even possible. And again, this is there's sort of proof in it in the fact that there was a sudden proliferation of Norse writings at around this period and like nothing from before that. Except, again, a line here, a line there that you would find inscribed on a rock or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The job, actually, prior to this, was left to the bards. The Scandinavians, the Vikings, and all that, they believed in an oral history. Their religion would have been oral in nature. Now, as I said, they did have these runes, and they were good for these simple lines. But they did have one other really important use, and that was for magic. These runes were not seen as so much letters, but as... there's a word for it, and I can't quite remember, but they're invested with power. Sigils, I think is the word. No, it's not the right word. Anyhow, so in this tradition, the Norse mythology, in that sense, may have actually last past conversion. But even this magic wasn't sort of to the gods. It was more like, again, to your ancestors, to spirits, magical beasts, that sort of thing. It seems that runes now and then are used not so much to communicate with people, but with other realms, whatever that might be. Now, I did mention that archaeology has found little about the religion of the Vikings, and that commentary about the Vikings but there is some commentary about people who were, you know, living with the Vikings at the time, and they wrote down stuff saying, hey, these Vikings, this weird sort of thing. It seems ambiguous as to with regards to whether Odin was a god or not. But there is a lot of evidence for things like ancestor worship. One of the comments were made was that, you know, traders would note that when Vikings set up a trading post, they put up these totems or these poles with carved heads on the top of them. Now, again, these may have been, you know, Thor and Odin, but most scholars actually believe they represented, you know, the founding fathers of that particular clan or tribe. And similar things can be found still in Scandinavia. One story that we're told about in this, and it was an attempted conversion of a Phrygian king. And it kind of sheds light on how important sort of ancestor worship was to the Norse. This Christian priest seems to have convinced a king to convert, but the king has one last question. He's reported to have said, "So, what happens to my dead king? Will they go to heaven as well?" And the priest, being honest, but I think missing something here, said, "Oh no, only those baptized are admitted to the kingdom of heaven." To which the king replied, "Well, then I shall not convert. I will spend eternity with my kin where I belong." So essentially saying, screw it, you know, I'd rather burn in this hell and be with my family than be alone in heaven. And so kin, family, and clans matter. Okay, so what? Well, unlike last week's show where I pointed out a bunch of falseness in ancient beliefs, this one I can't say. And I think in a way that kind of says a lot. See, if you ask a historian about the Vikings, they would have a lot to say about the evidence out there about their belief system and their art and their symbols. However, the problem is this is sort of a version of what I'd like to think of as anomaly hunting or finding what you're looking for. If you find a symbol of a hammer on a brooch, let's say, did it belong to a blacksmith? Maybe it was a famous king who destroyed his enemies, you know, like a hammer. Maybe it just looked good. But no, now all we see is Thor's hammer. One historian pointed out that if it was not for the Eddas, we would have no idea what the archaeology was saying. And in this case, and this is sort of the point of this article, I think, to quote George Orwell, "He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future." We likely will never know what the Vikings' real belief systems were pre-Christian. And somehow that just strikes me as a sad thing. Ethan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can make intelligent inferences. I mean, if the Vikings had a kin-based ancestry worshipping system, which is typical of sort of Northern Europe at the time, we can probably infer that it was similar to their neighbors. So, I mean, Eastern Europe and, you know, I bet we could even go back and say it's probably similar to the original indigenous inhabitants of that area, who I think were the Celts, who were then pushed into the Britain and then pushed further away. But I mean, you can sort of look at the surrounding peoples and kind of get an idea of what religion was like for them.
That was one of the interesting things when I was doing my research into this, that apparently to a certain degree, no, you can't. And not that what you said isn't logical and is not, it is done quite a bit in a lot of areas. But one of the interesting things apparently about these sort of pre-Christian pagan beliefs is, at least in places like Germany and France and Eastern Europe, a lot of it was deliberately wiped out. So any archaeological evidence that might have been left was purposely destroyed, as I will only assume, as part of the Christian cleansing of the area. You know, it might have taken them 1,000 years to sort of, you know, convert the people of the Germanics into Christianity. But once they did it, they were making sure there was no going back.
Yeah. Well, that's also, you know, a side effect of when you have cultures clash, usually one suppresses the other. But let's take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more after this.
Light up your summer with digital eco art. Come join the Locomoto Art Collective from 9 to 11 p.m. on Sunday, July 28th, for a stroll through one of Vancouver's crown jewels, Queen Elizabeth Park. Celebrating youth, technology, and nature, this family-friendly, free exhibition will include 12 visual projections, audio, sound art, interactive new media works in the large quarry, highlighting sustainable practices with technology.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
This time, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. Mars is missing. Okay, maybe not quite. Part of it is. There are a couple of, you know, sort of mysteries that have been purportedly solved that I sit back and say, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. One example that I like to point out is that the asteroid, the big famous asteroid, wiped out the dinosaurs. Well, why did it kill velociraptors but not the crocodiles?
Well, Don, you do know that crocodiles, go underground.
That's a good point. But evidence has shown that there's at least a few species of burrowing dinosaurs now found.
Well, you know, the crocodiles can live a long time without food.
Well, okay, that's another good point. Good point you have here. But what about birds? Can you do that one? No, I didn't think so. The latest theory on the dinosaurs point out that there are that their numbers were already sort of in decline. So, like, the old theory was, hey, asteroid wiped them all out. Now we say, you're right, that doesn't quite make sense. So now they sort of think, well, you know, they were probably on the way out to begin with before the asteroid ever hit. Some people suspected there may have been a pandemic that helped push things along. There was also the Daca traps, which was a massive outflow of lava lasting over 2 million years that could have caused massive and rapid climate change. So there's growing evidence that some of the dinosaurs may have actually survived the asteroid impact besides the birds, but died out soon afterwards, like within a million years. So that's one time where we seem to finally solve this niggling mystery that used to be solved. Another, quote, solved mystery is what happened to Mars' atmosphere. We're told that Mars, it doesn't have a magnetosphere to protect it like Earth does. So what's a magnetosphere, you may ask? Well, the Earth is surrounded by a giant magnetic field that is generated in our core. At the Earth's center, there's this large sort of nickel iron ball bearing, and it's immersed in sort of a metallic bath, and the Earth rotates, but as we all know, it doesn't always rotate at the same speed. Its laws of motion say that something that's further away from the center of mass will go slower than something close in. If you've ever seen like a figure skater do that spin and they have their arms out, and then as they pull it in, they come rapidly spin, well, that's sort of the effect. So what we end up having is we have a fast spinning core in a slower sort of metallic soup. And if we think of the soup more like a copper wire, then what we've actually described is an electric engine. And now, electricity and magnetism are sort of two forms of the same energy, and thanks to Maxwell and his equations, we basically have a gigantic magnetic dynamo in the center of our Earth. So Mars ain't got one, and the Sun stripped it of its atmosphere. Well, how would the Sun do this, you might ask? Well, the Sun is like a big fireball of sorts. If you put your hand over a campfire, you'd feel it give off smoke and hot air. Well, the Sun gives off matter sort of in a similar way, and it's called charged particles. This is called the solar wind. If you think of it as sort of a giant water sprinkler at the center of our solar system, spraying all the planets, and like a sprinkler, it will wash off the surfaces of these planets. Well, the parts that are sort of loosely attached, like an atmosphere. Earth does not have to worry about this because our magnetosphere acts as like a gigantic deflector. Mars, not so lucky. So we've been told that it's because of the sort of constant friction that over time Mars has been robbed of its air. Well, then explain Venus. Venus lacks a magnetosphere, and yet it has one of the thickest atmospheres in the solar system. Mars was, how did Mars' atmosphere get so thin? Well, finally, another paper that is help shed some light on this. A paper published in Science has, at least to my satisfaction, and what greater praise could there be? Well, a paper is pointing the finger at asteroids. Now, I know, obviously, our listeners are thinking what I'm thinking. Was it the same asteroid that helped kill off the dinosaurs? Do we have a serial killer? No. Asteroids are suicide bombers. One kill per hit.
Well, the big ones can... I guess you need a pretty big asteroid to take out two planets.
It would be, yeah.
Like a moon-sized.
No, more like a Jupiter, I think.
Really? Well, yeah.
I think what you might be thinking of, and it could be, is the offspring of a asteroid. So if it slams into the Earth and spews off or gives birth to, it could be a whole family.
Yeah, if it was big enough, it could just like split in half and, yeah.
Going back to the science.
Yes,
part.
Yes, of course.
The paper is based upon measurements made by the Curiosity Explorer on Mars. Previous measurements had shown that their amount of heavy isotopes of hydrogen and carbon, et cetera, implied that at one time Mars had a denser atmosphere. So first, just for those people out there who might not know what I'm talking about, elements are essentially defined by the number of protons in its core. But that's only like one-third of the members that comprise an atom. Atoms also contain electrons, which it can lose, gain, or share with other atoms to form chemical bonds. When the total number of electrons do not equal the total number of protons, we call this an ion of that element. So if you had like a chemical formula, if you've ever seen one, these additions or minuses are literally done with pluses and minuses. So if you saw an oxygen ion, let's say stole two electrons, it would be written O, which is a symbol for oxygen, plus two. So that's an ion. The third partner in an atom is the neutron. They have no charge, so they can be added or removed without really changing the chemical nature of the atom. So a quite normal carbon has six protons, six electrons, six neutrons, and we call that carbon-12 because the neutrons and the protons equal 12. However, sometimes carbon atoms form that have an extra neutron. And this is where we get carbon-13 and carbon-14, which have one and two extra neutrons, respectively. Now, these elements are often sometimes unstable in a nuclear sort of sense of the term, and they give off radiation. But chemically, they're pretty much the same. So, lesson's over. Let's go back to Mars. So, Curiosity has instruments that are better at making these measurements of the isotopes, and they have actually shown that the amount of carbon-13 was a lot greater about 4 billion years in the past. More importantly, it shows that there was actually a dramatic decrease in the thickness of Mars' atmosphere at, like, bang, one point, and then there was a sort of slow erosion over time. It's now suspected that about 4 billion years ago, Mars, similar to Earth, was hit by a Pluto-sized asteroid that not only transformed the surface, but may have ejected most of Mars' atmosphere into space. And by transforming the surface, if you ever look at a topographical map of Mars, it's really weird. It's like the whole northern hemisphere has sort of been pushed in, and the whole southern hemisphere has been pulled out, which I think is evidence for an impact, but that's not my specialty. Mm-hmm. Thoughts, Ethan?
Well, I mean, it makes theoretical sense. There's so many different ideas about Mars, and it's kind of hard to keep track of all the different science that's coming out of, you know, the Red Planet, thanks to Curiosity and other endeavors. So from my spot looking in, I have a hard time keeping track of everything that I hear. And generally speaking, based on my understanding of how science works, usually I try to wait a little bit because I know that there's probably some astrophysicist who's just pulling their hair out over this study, I'm sure, somewhere. So they're probably going to write some blistering reply about how these scientists are idiots, and really this is what happened.
Well, there's actually another study that was part of this, but I didn't include in it. I'm not sure why at the moment, but that actually was talking about water on Mars.
Right.
And it showed that, you know, there seems to have been about two-thirds of the planet was covered in water, again, about 4 billion years ago. And if Mars had a thin atmosphere, this couldn't be. Right. So it's not like, you know, smoking gun, but it's the shadow of smoking gun.
Well, I mean, if Mars had, say, a protective magnetosphere like the Earth did and lost it somehow, or it was interrupted in some way, and the atmosphere started to ebb away, that, I mean, it could have one drastic impact, boom, it's gone, but it would also probably have long-term effects. I mean, I think that there's been some pretty interesting studies out of Mars saying that it's had running water not too long ago in reasonable time. So, I mean, it's possible that Mars has been a dying planet for millions of years.
True. And as you say, there may be a rebuttal to the isotopic evidence. But the isotope says no. It was like most of it was done at one point and then a gradual diminishment over time. But yeah, who knows?
Right? Well, and also, I mean, if the planet was volcanically active, I mean, if something hit it that big, you think there would be other ramifications, right? So maybe you had underground rivers being dragged to the surface, oceans being covered. Who knows, right?
Well, I covered that, Ethan. If you look at the topographical,
I wasn't listening to what you were saying, Don.
If you look at the topographical map of Mars, I mean, it's like someone took a punch to its belly.
Yeah,
right.
It's a weird planet.
You have this big depression in the north, and a big sort of expression in the south. Well, but yeah, I don't know. I think it proves the point to my satisfaction, and honestly, I think that's all the evidence you should require.
Well, normally I do go by what you say, Don, but let's go to another quick break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back to talk about porn.
Woo-hoo!
After this.
With lots of graphics.
Graphics?
Well.
Descriptions?
I mean pictures.
Oh, yeah. Well, for us.
Yes.
All right. Stay tuned, folks.
CITR is proud to support the 20th anniversary season of the Enchanted Evenings concert series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden. Unwind at the end of every week with an eclectic musical performance. All concerts begin at 7 p.m. every Friday from July 5th to August 30th. For more information, go to VancouverChineseGarden.com.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR.
Porn.
Okay, well, calm down, Don. We're just talking about it.
I just can't help but be excited. It's like we're going to talk about porn on the show. That's so good. Sorry. Seriously, folks.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's bad news, especially for our UK listeners. It appears that Parliament is going to pass a controversial new set of laws that will ban internet porn for citizens of the UK.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's right. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, has announced that new legislation stating that porn was, quote, corroding childhood, end quote. Cameron went on to say that, quote, horrific internet search terms would be blacklisted, meaning they would automatically bring up no results on websites like Google or Bing. He told the BBC he expected a row with service providers.
I think it's pronounced row.
Row, really?
Yes.
Okay. He said in his speech, though, because he thought that they were, quote, not doing enough to take responsibility, despite having a moral duty to do so.
I got to love the consistency of conservatives around the world. You know, the whole idea of conservatives is like, we want a small government, we want to get out of here. But the minute sex comes into it, oh yeah, they got to be all over your junk and et cetera. It's very, but consistently bad.
Yeah. Well, he also warned that he would have to force action by changing the law. If there were no advancements, and that the technical obstacles that are facing internet providers, well, they should get their greatest brains to overcome them. So here we have David Cameron basically saying, listen, think of the children and, you know,
if you're not with me, you're with the pedophiles.
Yeah. Here's what he said, expanded, quote, I want to talk about the internet, the impact it is having on the innocence of our children, how online pornography is corroding childhood, and how in the darkest corners of the internet there are things going on that are a direct danger to our children and that must be stamped out. I'm not making this speech because I want to moralize or scaremonger, but because I feel profoundly as a politician and as a father that the time for action has come. This is, quite simply, about how to protect our children and their innocence. So, it's pretty simple, actually. You have on one side of the issue protecting children, and on the other side, privacy-desiring perverts. So, where do you stand, Don?
Well, first of all, I must admit the timing of this is convenient, as just as England is dipping back into recession, suddenly it's like, well, let's not try and fix the economy. Let's not talk about the fact that they've just cut back benefits to people who are unemployed and so, people who can't get work. No, let's talk about how our children are seeing wangs on the internet. That is the greatest fear. And actually, I think in the way you worded that, you kind of have, you've kind of bifurcated it in a very interesting way. There are two problems he has in here, I think. One, kids seeing porn. Right? And, I mean, I hate to say this, but I think that's actually a good thing. I mean, yes, sure, there are certain kind of porns that you might want to have a sit-down with little Johnny to explain with him, no, you, that's not what you're supposed to be doing, like rape and that sort of stuff, right? But, I mean, in general, the whole idea of what's the word I'm trying to use here? Like, when I was a kid, right? You know, you'd almost, like, kill to get a hold of a porno mag, right? I mean, it was like platinum gold, right? But now you got kids sitting there trying to get rid of the crap because it's coming through their email as junk mail all the time, right? So they no longer see, you know, nudity and sex as a big issue. It's just, it's like breathing, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually healthy for a society. But the second part that I think he's trying to get at, and I'm being generous here, is that, yes, the internet is this big communication medium that allows predators to talk kids into doing something naughty online. That's a big one, apparently, is sort of this trying to get a kid to do something sexual on Skype. I mean, Skype is a really weird technology. It's, again, changing how we interact. Or the other ones where, you know, hey, let's meet at this particular place, and then whammo-bammo, you know, the kid gets raped or something worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
But those are two separate things. I mean, having a porn filter is not going to protect children from, as you put it so nicely, privacy desiring perverts, right? I mean, dear, you can sit there and I can say, hi, how's it going? Oh, nice and fine. Hey, do you want to go for a coffee? But you're like 49 years old. I know, but you seem mature for 10. That's not even going to be addressed.
You have a lot of experience with this, don't you, Don?
That's not even going to be addressed at all by this particular thing. So I don't see how that's protecting the children. But we're early on.
Well, you're right. I obviously gave a relatively simplistic breakdown of the story. And I get that the first reaction might be to panic or start stockpiling. But actually, when I looked into the details of these sort of new anti-porn laws, I found some interesting, well, inconsistencies and interesting factoids. So, first of all, from what I've been able to decipher, these new laws will basically make online porn subject to the same legal restrictions as, I guess for lack of a better word, physical porn. So if you're 15 and you walk into an adult sex shop and try to buy some Playboys, they're not going to sell them to you. Likewise, internet providers will still allow porn, but by default, their filters have been turned on. So this means you have to tell the provider, I want the porn, or they won't give it to you. So, I mean, you could sort of say, okay, well, this is like a 15-year-old, you know, going into Google and saying, I want some porn. They say, hey, on, how old are you? No, no porn for you.
One of the things I was reading in preparation for the show was an interesting thing is that they're going to have to make this sophisticated enough, right, so that it filters out, but not too sophisticated that the adult can't figure out how to get around it because, you know, ostensibly, adults should be allowed to access this porn.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to make it dumb enough so that an adult can do it. But at the same time, we have these like extremely tech-savvy teenagers out there.
Yeah.
Right? And they're going to have to ban search terms.
Well, see, the thing is, though, like it's not necessarily designed to filter out in the sense that you can't access it. It's that you actually have to call your internet provider and say, I want porn allowed on my connection. Because it's actually ISP level blocking they're talking about here, right? It's not so much like your browser has a filter or something. But moving on here, so you know, if you're going to make, say, an adult film, you have certain legal requirements. You have to cast people who are 18 years old or older, depending on your jurisdiction. You have to keep records, and this has to be reviewed by law enforcement to make sure, you know, everything is consensual, et cetera, that kind of thing. So with online porn, though, especially because of the nature of online porn, it can be very difficult to track down who made the content. And because, I mean, a lot of times it's just being shared on, 2.0 web style video sites. And it's very difficult to figure out, well, who even made this and how can we find out if they were consenting adults? And so these set of laws can make it so that if you want to host porn in the UK, you have to make sure that you have these records available for law enforcement to look into, which I think is probably a good idea. I mean, I don't see any reason why that's a bad thing. The other big issue is that examples of, quote, extreme porn are to be banned, basically outlawed. So this would include depictions of rape in porn. And in fact, this is one of the few examples of extreme porn that I could find, other than things like necrophilia and other things. And basically, you wouldn't even be able to get simulated rape scenes in porn. Now, I realize obviously this is like a sensitive issue and, nobody wants to see real rape in porn, but it has been shown that there are people who actually have healthy rape fantasies in a healthy sex life.
Well, I think, well, first of all, the whole idea of bondage, domination, S&M, which although are extreme in my opinion, but there seem to be healthy couples that enjoy that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, oh, I forgot what I was going to say. Yeah.
Well, I think maybe where you were going with this is that where do you draw that line? Because, like we said, like everyone would agree that if you are filming a real rape scene and putting it out there, that's horrible and that's against the law. But what about when you have like porn actors come in? They say, okay, we're going to do a simulated, you know, kinky BDSM type thing, and there's going to be a simulated rape, and everybody knows going into it that it's fake, and that. What if that is part of the healthy sex life for consenting adults to watch that and have sex?
Two things. One thing I remembered from, well, first of all, which you just brought up. What's the difference between them being naked and them not being naked? I mean, how many times do you see in a movie rape scenes, right? I mean,
right.
So it's not like you're banning rape because it objectifies women or because there are other issues to it. And I don't mean, you know, a documentary pointing out how bad rape is. I mean, like, there are a number of movies and shows that do seem to sort of glorify the rape scene as action.
Well, I mean,
and
Clockwork Orange has dramatic rape scenes in it.
Exactly. But the other thing a lot of people have talked about is the priesthood and celibacy. You know,
right.
That if you deny priests the ability to sort of exercise their sexual urges in some manner or other, I mean, like they can't even masturbate legally, that it will eventually break out in something that's even worse than this sort of recreational venue. So in that same sense, if you kind of believe that priests should be allowed to have sex or at least release themselves sexually, that would seem to mean, well, you'd have to kind of support this area, at least in a limited way.
Well, I mean, looking at the way the laws are panning out, it is interesting that the UK is not so much banning porn, but it's nonetheless deciding what is, quote, extreme porn, which is, you know, a bizarre thing for the government to be doing, in my opinion. And it's also putting social pressure on the citizen who has to ask for porn to be allowed to see it, which I think is kind of, it's sort of like shaming, really.
Well, actually, no and yes. So, again, we're dealing with different media outlets, that sort of thing, right?
Right.
So there's going to be a difference between your interpretation and my interpretation. I was reading The Guardian just earlier today, and they were actually pointing out that the telco, the ISPs, the big ones, are actually lobbied against this, successfully lobbied against it. And so it's not default on. It's actually what they call active ask.
Hmm.
So when you sign up, they say, we have two plans, with or without porn. I mean, I don't quite put it that way, but actually with or without parental controls. That's the word.
Right.
And you have to actively choose one or the other. Right, but apparently, because of this defeat, the Cameron government went to them and says, "Well, do you mind if we just say it's default on? I mean, it won't really be default on, but we want to use that term, and we don't want you guys coming back and getting all upset." And which is a whole other political issue on itself.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, it's not like they're saying you have to call them, please, so I may have some porn. But there is, I think, an element of, you know, we all know what these controls are there to prevent. Right. So, like, you know, having someone have to say, yeah, I don't want any parental controls, it implies, you know, you're going to be doing something with that without those controls. Now, moving on, I think, to the concerns that privacy activists might have is that these seem to be kind of window dressing laws to promote a conservative moralistic crusade. Let's consider some of the finer points of the regulations. One, banning and preventing child porn, this is what Don was getting at earlier, all sensible people want to do this, right? Yeah. And there's debate on how is the best way to go about doing this. And the funny thing is, well, not funny, but the reality is that most internet providers are already on board with this. Google and Microsoft already have in place systems to eliminate child porn from their internet searches. They go out of their way to cooperate with law enforcement to track down pedophiles and people who create child porn. And I mean, like, what do these new laws add to this process that isn't already in place?
Well, one interesting technical, not hitch, good part, I heard about it. Apparently they're doing some hashtagging to a lot of these. So when they find, like, a you know, here's a porn picture or video, they do a mathematical calculation and they derive this number that sort of identifies that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if anyone does, if they do a search or they're doing a bot or whatever, and they find this hashtag, it's blocked automatically, right? So it's kind of crowdsourced version of censorship using advanced super technology by aliens.
Hmm.
Yes.
Well, sort of another point regarding this is the regulation of porn, which, generally speaking, I think is probably a good idea, because I think that there are problems with making sure that online porn is obeying the same rules that you have for, like, magazines and studios that produce videos, which is making sure the actors are of legal age, that they're consenting, they're being safe. I mean, there's been lots of controversy, I know, in America with forcing porn actors to use birth control, condoms, and things to prevent the spreads of STDs. And I think, you know, those are probably really good things. And I think you maybe can even go further than that and have, like, healthcare and, like, benefits and insurance for porn actors.
And an odd sort of thing, again, as if when porn becomes more acceptable and just an everyday part of the thing, one of the classical condemnations of it is, you know, it's like CD and you get drug abuse and you get sex slavery and all that. Well, the more you bring it into the mainstream, the less of that happens.
Yeah, the more regulation, the more protection you can put onto the industry, you can make it less CD. You can make it less controlled by, you know, people who want to do harm.
And conversely, the more you just ban it outright, it's still going to exist. You know,
you're just pushing it underground, basically.
Exactly, and you're allowing these abuses to continue even worse.
Right. So the other point that comes up, obviously, is preventing porn from being viewed by young people, keeping adult content away from children. And again, I think most sensible people think this is probably a good idea, that you don't want to have, you know, hardcore porn being watched by kids. But the other side of this is that, well, how are you defining what is adult content, and, you know, where are you selectively going to be looking for it? There's a lot of adult content on YouTube. There's lots of content on Tumblr and Flickr and Twitter and everywhere, basically. The internet is everywhere. How are you going to police it all, and where are you going to go? I mean, I think for most kids, if, you know, if you're 14 and you want to see, you know, naked people, you're probably going to, the first thing you're going to do is check YouTube. I mean, that's ubiquitous, isn't it? Like, you probably don't even know where to go to look for hardcore porn, but you probably know how to search YouTube.
Yes.
So I think that if you're focusing on keeping away kids from the, you know, the porn sites, well, you may want to redirect your efforts to places where kids actually are going to go.
Well, you see, so again, I guess I'm not a sensible human being in your context. I think that's the wrong conversation to have. I think the porn is out there. I think kids are going to get to the porn. Just in the same way that there's violence out there, there are extreme graphic videos out there, that sort of thing. There's videos of jackass, of people doing stupid things, you know.
Yeah.
And kids are going to see that. Where the conversation needs to be had is between the child and the parent. To say, this is the context for this material. You're going to see it eventually. I can try and shield you, whatever, on. But in doing so, I've only postponed this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So by sitting there acknowledging that it's there and it's going to get out there, have the conversation with the kid and say, hey, you know, beating up hobos? You shouldn't be doing that. And this is why. This kind of hardcore sex at your age? Not good. And this is why, you know, this is the, and providing the context for the issue. Cause as you point, you proved my point in a way. It's everywhere and they're going to get it. You know, I thought it was hilarious that when Twitter released its video thing, Vine, and we've mentioned this on the show, it took like 30 seconds before it became a porn outlet.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, the aspect of this is that it is so ubiquitous and out there, and our culture is saturated with adult content. I don't understand where you're going to go to start trying to prevent little kids from getting their hands on it. And again, if you consider, you know, before the internet was around, young teenagers were just as eager to get their hands on the latest Playboy. They would bribe the nearest 18-year-old they could find to go into 7-Eleven and buy them one. I think that, you know, you're dealing with this sort of thing as well. And I was going to mention that one of the best ways to, I think, instruct children and to guide them is to talk to them about this, and to, for parents and, you know, teachers and et cetera, to sit down with kids and say, this is why porn is porn. This is what it's there for. And maybe this is why you should be careful around it. I mean, there actually is evidence that early exposure to adult content can have serious consequences on kids. It can give them the wrong impression. It can give them the wrong ideas of what to do, or have unrealistic views on sex, or views on women, or views on their own body. So there are reasons why you need to talk to kids and help them understand why porn can sometimes be the wrong thing.
I think, again, I guess I would agree with you partly in what you just said, because you're right, because there are certain things. But that begins, again, the responsibility of the adult and the parents, of the situation. And what Britain's trying to do, it's kind of sort of saying, well, we're going to assume that everybody is like 6 years old. And it would be kind of equivalent to saying, listen, well, we shouldn't let six-year-olds run around outside without guardianship, right? So before you're allowed to leave your house, you have to apply for permission to say, I'm an adult, I want to leave my house. And they say, okay, you can, right? It doesn't sound like much, but I mean, if you actually had something like that, people would be so up in arms about it. Well, it's just really the same thing, right? It is assuming that, well, at least the way Cameron envisions with the default on, that everyone out there is 6 years old. And we're going to apply that condition to everyone, because those kids who are 6 years old, either they're all irresponsible parents or there's some such thing. And trust me, if you are an irresponsible parent, the porn is probably going to be the least harmful thing you're doing to your child, right? I mean, there are crack addicts out there. There are alcoholics. There are sexual perverts who are parents, right? So, I mean, you know, the parent's job is to protect the child, and to whatever degree you think it necessary, excluding religion. No one should have religion. But that's your job. That's why you're the parent. Now, if you want to hand that off to the state, great. Then we'll have my socialist utopia where children are brought up in a big communal area and given proper food. And well, that's a different topic. So, Ethan, what can we do? Is this going to come to Canada?
Well, I don't know. It really sort of depends on, I think, the how this goes over. One thing, I want to read a quote from something that I read in the Atlantic Wire about this story. I think this is relevant. So, quote, ultimately, the question here will be if the porn crackdown will ultimately result in less child abuse and better treatment of women. If you look at countries that ban porn and ones that don't, you'll notice that at best, there's no clear relationship between banning porn and that country's treatment of women and children. At worst, a ban on porn is perhaps harmful. For example, take a look at India, where the distribution of porn is illegal. That country has recently become notorious for an epidemic of brutal rapes, some of them against children. Meanwhile, in the United States, the incidence of rape declined 85% over a period of 25 years, while access to pornography increased. The UK is probably closer to the US in that stark comparison, and is regularly rated as one of the top countries in the world for women. That's not to say that porn is good for gender relations, only that any relationship between banning porn and positive outcomes is unclear. And I think that's really where I would fall along on the spectrum, is that, sure, there are improvements to be made, and that there are benefits you can have to regulating porn and having conversations with your kids about porn, but banning it, there's really no evidence that's even beneficial. And frankly, there's not a lot of evidence or research being done to understand what is the best method for equipping kids to deal with the trials and tribulations of the adult world.
And going back to where I started with this, sort of begin with, is this really the most pressing issue that Cameron has to deal with in his nation? I mean,
he's got to be careful, because there's a new king on the scene in England.
And no, we're not supposed to mention that.
And he's probably going to, you know, take over and, well, cause problems for them.
Did you know that every child born the same day he was born gets a silver penny?
Really?
Yeah, apparently the UK Mint has minted something like 2,100 silver pennies to be given out to every child that was born on that day, based on the folklore that a newborn's palm crossed with silver is good fortune to the family or whatever. So last thing I'm going to say about this one, and actually I'm going to try to do a radio play here, so forgive me if it doesn't sound quite right, but at The Guardian, they kind of end their segment with envisioning a particular call after this default on porn filter comes on. So, hello. Yes, hello. I can't access some of the internet. Do you mean porn? No, some websites. Porn sites? No, just sites with porn on them. Yes, 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 all right. What kind of an internet service provider doesn't include porn in the standard package? Sorry, it just struck me as funny.
Well, I mean, it is kind of funny because if you think about, the typical stereotypical Englishman being somewhat fastidious and,
wink, wink, nudge, nudge, wink, same wink, wall, nudge, same nudge. Wall.
Yeah, so, I mean, it makes sense, I guess, in some sense.
Yes. Well, you know, and it what's the word? It's a disrespectful for the fact that the internet probably would not exist if it wasn't for porn.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are certain instincts that are universal in human beings.
Yeah, it's, you look at cave paintings, some of the very first. In fact, I think it's been argued dubiously that the very first rock painting was of a woman doing stuff.
Well, I mean, our art has always been influenced by sex, and it only makes sense that our first art was influenced by sex.
I always thought it was influenced by our biological movements, because so much of it seems like crap.
Funny. Well,
highlights.
Yes, we're out of time here on Radio for Thinkers, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Don, do you have one?
I have one, and actually it's not really a skeptic highlight for me, but I thought if you heard this, Ethan, you might go, what? And jump at this.
Okay.
An evening with hockey heroes.
Hmm.
Mix and mingle with hockey legends, and you'll correct my bad pronunciation. Yvonne Cornoro?
I have no clue.
Henry Richard?
Okay.
Mike Bossy.
Okay.
They're going to have a meet and greet. There'll be appetizers, live and silent auctions, a Q&A session. It's at the River Rock Resort. You like hockey, don't you?
Yeah, it's okay.
Do you like it $198 worth?
Not that much.
No. Who's Henry Richard?
Henry Richard, old hockey player.
Not Rocket Richard.
No.
He's dead, isn't he?
Maurice the Rocket Richard, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know, actually.
So, yeah, if you're into hockey, here's a chance to meet with, people who are doing the circuit. It's like going to see the Rolling Stones, maybe. They're kind of past their prime, but still to say, hey, I saw them.
I've seen the Rolling Stones, and they are definitely not past their prime. Just saying. Anyway, my skeptical highlight is happening on August 10th. It's the CFI Freethinkers Book Club, and the book they're reading is When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God by T.M. Lerman. Again, this is happening August 10th at 1 p.m., which is a Saturday, at the Grind Coffee Shop in Vancouver. And it's free by donation if you want. And you don't have to read the book to show up. You just have to show up and talk about it. And it's available at the Vancouver Public Library, as well as Chapters and Indigo bookstores.
There is a book, I haven't read it yet, or my version of reading, that is about how to talk about books you haven't actually read. And it's designed to sort of cover the classics and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
I haven't got into it, but that would be an interesting book to have for your book group.
Yeah, how to sound intelligent without actually being intelligent.
Well, I do that every week.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is free.